Well, good morning. Welcome. Hey, we have 45 minutes. This is great. So I'm actually going to attempt to keep this shorter. And like I mentioned yesterday in the text, leave some time for you to share your Red Sea experiences if you have some you'd like to share with us. for those of you that are visiting, we're in the middle of a series I'm calling the story, the big story, and we're at part 12. And the series is about just how God worked in through the Old Testament, pointing to Jesus, and how that the whole of Scripture is one big story that points forward to what Jesus did on the cross. And right now we're in the Exodus, finally actually ready for the actual Exodus. When I got started on the story of the plagues and stuff, I expected to kind of jump right into the Red Sea experience, maybe make the plagues and the Red Sea all one thing, and ended up getting hung up on the plagues for about five episodes here. So finally ready to get out of that. So I'm going to start off. If you know me, I like some details. Last time we looked at the final plague, and I'm going to actually, Marcus, if you could put up the map, not the one with the audio, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but I thought for the sake of just giving you a little bit of a visual. So when I started digging into this, I spent probably 2 or 3 hours trying to understand the actual route, and finally came to the conclusion that there just really isn't any smoking gun as to where the actual route is. About as many different scholars as there are that study this, they have their own opinions. So there's a couple of them on here. The one thing we do have fairly certain is kind of where they started out from. So we're talking somewhere in this area anyway, the land of Goshen. But then from there, I mean, it could have been that they came down through here. One of the newer hypotheses is that the actual crossing was about right in here. But there's some issues with that theory because of how long it would take to get down here, and it doesn't quite line up with the timeline. The more traditional one is this one right here, which would have them crossing somewhere in this area or possibly down in this area, which would probably line up a little bit better with the timeline. If you go with this theory, then the Mount Sinai would need to be over here, which is possible. But the traditional view has been that Mount Sinai is right in here, which is where they went after the Red Sea. Now, I don't know how many of you heard this. There was a guy by the name of Ron Wyatt who supposedly discovered chariot wheels in the bottom of the Red Sea. And it was kind of a big news thing. Like, it was kind of plastered all over Christian YouTube channels and different stuff. The problem was it was all a hoax. The guy was completely a nut job. I mean, he supposedly discovered Noah's Ark and Goliath's sword and the Tower of Babel and just a bunch of different stuff. And nobody really dug into it, at least on the Christian side, and said, wait a minute, this is not actually true. We shouldn't even be, reporting on this. And so it ended up kind of hurting the very cause, because any archaeologist that dug into it were like, no, there's nothing there. He's just going on some coral that's there that, you know, he never even documented. So there isn't really a smoking gun as to where they crossed, even though if you do any digging online, you'll see like, oh, we found where they crossed because here's chariot wheels, when it's not really a thing. So anyway, I just say that to say it doesn't hurt the case of what Scripture says. We don't have to rely on archaeology to find it, to believe that it happened. And I think we're all at that place. It doesn't. And I thought Trenton's little talk on what truth is, it was a month ago or so, where he talked about truth is not based on science. Truth is based on God. And if science backs that up, that's fine. That's great, but that's not what we base it on. Anyway, don't want to spend a ton of time on that, but I'm going to actually play the text for us this morning. There's a lot of fun names that I'm probably not qualified to pronounce. And I'm going to play a dramatized version. I've done this before. I think it really brings out the story when you can hear the different voices kind of playing it out. And the map should stay up while that's playing. So if you want to turn to Exodus 13, it is kind of a big chunk of scripture here. And we could actually even start before this, because we didn't cover all of this in our last time. There's the institution of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which we didn't really get into. Consecration of the firstborn. But I think for sake of time, we're going to start at verse 17. So Exodus 13, verse 17, and then we're going to go through the end of chapter 14. And you're welcome to follow along with us as this plays.
When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said,
"Lest the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt."
But God led the people around by the way of the wilderness toward the Red Sea. And the people of Israel went up out of the land of Egypt equipped for battle. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for Joseph had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying,
"God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones with you from here."
And they moved on from Succoth and encamped at Etham, on the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them along the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, that they might travel by day and by night. The pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night did not depart from before the people. Exodus 14. Then the Lord said to Moses,
"Tell the people of Israel to turn back and encamp in front of Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, in front of Baal-Zephon. You shall encamp facing it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the people of Israel, 'They are wandering in the land. The wilderness has shut them in.' And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord."
And they did so. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, the mind of Pharaoh and his servants was changed toward the people. And they said,
"What is this we have done, that we have let Israel go from serving us?"
So he made ready his chariot and took his army with him, and took 600 chosen chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the people of Israel while the people of Israel were going out defiantly. The Egyptians pursued them, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them and camped at the sea by Pi-Hahiroth, in front of Baal-Zephon. When Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they feared greatly. And the people of Israel cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses,
"Is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is not this what we said to you in Egypt? Leave us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness."
And Moses said to the people,
"Fear not. Stand firm and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to be silent."
The Lord said to Moses,
"Why do you cry to me? Tell the people of Israel to go forward. Lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, that the people of Israel may go through the sea on dry ground. And I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they shall go in after them. And I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host, his chariots and his horsemen. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gotten glory over Pharaoh, his chariots and his horsemen.
Then the angel of God, who was going before the host of Israel, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them, coming between the host of Egypt and the host of Israel. And there was the cloud and the darkness, and it lit up the night without one coming near the other all night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. And the people of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. The Egyptians pursued and went in after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And in the morning watch, the Lord in the pillar of fire and of cloud looked down on the Egyptian forces and threw the Egyptian forces into a panic, clogging their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily. And the Egyptians said,
"Let us flee from before Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians."
Then the Lord said to Moses,
"Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the water may come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots and upon their horsemen."
So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal course when the morning appeared. And as the Egyptians fled into it, the Lord threw the Egyptians into the midst of the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen. Of all the host of Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea, not one of them remained. But the people of Israel walked on dry ground through the sea, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Israel saw the great power that the Lord used against the Egyptians. So the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses.
Quite the account. There's actually another account in Numbers. I just wanted to read two verses from it because it brings out something that isn't really mentioned in the Exodus account. It's Numbers 33, verse 3 and 4. It says, "They set out from Ramses in the first month, on the 15th day of the first month, on the day after the Passover, the people of Israel went out triumphantly in the sight of all the Egyptians, while the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn, whom the Lord had struck down among them. On their gods also the Lord executed judgments." One of the commentaries I was reading kind of elaborated on that thought a little bit, how that they went out triumphantly. For over 100 years, they had been the slaves, and we didn't really get into this either in this part of the text, but earlier we saw that the Egyptians gave them all this stuff, and were like, "Just get out of here, just get out of here." So essentially, they stole all the valuables out of Egypt as they were leaving. And in Numbers there, it says they left triumphantly while they were still burying their dead. Can you imagine this parade of Israelites marching out with all your valuables while you're still burying your firstborn? And what a difference that is between how they were living just days before that. I mean, what a change happened because God moved. The thing that I thought about in that was, or one thing that I thought about is, you know, the Israelites had been slaves for over 100 years, and they had been persecuted, their babies killed, and it looked like God didn't care. And I know we've talked about this a lot during the plagues, but the thing that really hit me is they didn't have the power to bring justice to the Egyptians. Even though they had been treated so badly, they had no power to bring justice to what they had done. And even if Moses had kind of mustered all the people together and turned them into an army and tried to fight their way out of Egypt, they never would have left the same way. They might have been able to leave if God would have blessed that, but they wouldn't have been able to bring Egypt to its knees like God did with just a few miracles. I had to think of 20 years ago when the United States kind of went to war with Afghanistan after 9/11. I would have been 12 at that time, I think. Maybe I'm not remembering everything exactly the way it was, but as I remember, the reason for doing it was to bring justice to what happened on 9/11. And so we quickly go in there and take over this country and end up being there for 20 years. And in 9/11, there were 2,996 people were killed in the United States on that day in 9/11. But in going into Afghanistan, another 2,300 U.S. soldiers were killed and countless civilians. I think it's a little bit hard to tally that up, but over 100,000 civilians were killed. And then if you also count in the Iraq wars, we're up to over 7,000 more Americans that died because of trying to exact revenge on what happened on 9/11. And I'm not saying that that was not justified or that, you know, as far as human governments work, that should not have necessarily been the case. My point is, when humans try to exact justice on something, it's never like God can do it. And usually there ends up being a whole lot more lives lost, even on the side that is trying to exact justice. Whereas with God, when he did it, not a single Israelite was killed or even injured. It says that not even a dog was going to bark at them as they were leaving. And I think, you know, in our personal lives, we're going to be injured sometimes by other people. When we try to exact justice on that, it never ends well. And I think we've all seen that. If you haven't experienced it yourself, you've seen it in other people. God ultimately is the one that is going to bring justice to the injustices that we see here. And I think we should leave it at that, let God do that. Anyway, verse 13, or chapter 13, 17 and 18, it talks about why God led them into the wilderness. And you still have the map up there. If you look at the top row there, or the top path up here, this would have been a much more direct route to get into Canaan. And we can see how much more direct that is than going all the way down here into the wilderness. And what's not on that map there is the fact that there's actually a really main road. It was probably the largest trading route between the areas up here in Canaan all the way down into Egypt. It was called the Via Maris. It's called the Way of the Sea, and it followed the Mediterranean Sea kind of all the way up into some of the other countries up there. And it was a main trading route, so Egypt had a bunch of kind of outposts through here. Even though it was out of their country, they had little outposts through here to kind of protect their own interests because they were doing a lot of trading. So big wide road, it would have made a lot of sense to just take that. But God knew that because those Egyptian outposts were there, they may end up having to fight their way through stuff. So that's why it says that God took them down into the wilderness. Lest they see war. So verse 17 says, lest they see war and decide to return to Egypt. Now apparently it wouldn't have taken a whole lot to convince them to return, because all they had to see was some Egyptians coming after them and they were already ready to go back. So apparently God knew that they weren't exactly trusting in him yet. One thing we notice right away is that this is not Moses leading the people, though. God is directly deciding where the people go. That pillar of cloud and fire makes it pretty clear who's actually in charge here. And this is a supernatural event from the beginning. There's another reason that God led the people into the wilderness, and I think it's the same reason that God really does everything he ever has done, and that it was for his own glory. If the Israelites had gone the easiest way and just walked up to Canaan, they would have never had to cross the Red Sea, and they wouldn't have experienced that miracle that happened at the Red Sea, and we probably wouldn't be talking about it. Now, we might still be talking about what God did in the plagues, but as far as what God did at the Red Sea and completely destroying the Egyptian army, that wouldn't have needed to happen if they hadn't come to the Red Sea there. So as I was reading through this account, I don't know, just that little comment by Pharaoh in chapter 14, verse 5, it just kind of hit me as pretty funny, maybe in a kind of a dark way. I'll just read that again. He says, "When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, the mind of Pharaoh and his servants had changed toward the people, and they said, 'What is this thing that we have done that we have let Israel go from serving us?'" Now just think through that comment a little bit. What have we done in letting them go? I mean, hello, there's 10 pretty good reasons you let them go here. Did you kind of forget all about that, or what's going on here? I don't know, I had to think maybe his hard drive was a little corrupted there, just was not functioning anymore. You're dealing with a force that can wipe out all the firstborns in your country, and you're ready to go running after them again and bring them back. I mean, I guess I'm thinking, maybe he's thinking that God kind of ran out of power on plague number 10 and he doesn't have any more options. So I don't know, you know, going after them with an army of 600 chariots, yeah, that's a lot of power, especially in that time, but you're dealing with something far greater than that, and you're ready to bring that back into your country. It seems absolutely crazy. I mean, when you think about it, Pharaoh's response to this whole thing is just doesn't make any sense. But then when we look at how the Israelites responded when they kind of hit a crisis, the only difference really between the two is that we can identify with the Israelites. None of us have had the option of having an entire army at our command. I don't think so, at least not if you're listening to this right now. Whereas we've all been in a place where we don't know what to do next, like we're stuck. Maybe not at the level that the Israelites were there. But we can still identify with that, I think. Like, what is God going to do? It doesn't look like we have any options here. And so right away, we're not trusting God. And in essence, that's the same thing that Pharaoh was doing, not believing that God was still going to take care of his people. Otherwise, unless he just completely had lost his ability to reason, it didn't make sense to go after them again if the same God was still with them. But the Israelites had the same response, essentially. They didn't believe that God was going to take care of them either. And I had to think, like, you know, when I'm in a tough spot, my first reaction is, I don't know that it's ever been like, wow, this is a great opportunity for God to show himself. But I think maybe we should think more that way. Because I think that's a lack of faith when we don't. The other thing I notice here is that the Israelites right away wanted to blame somebody. And I think that's pretty much how we are. They blamed Moses, even though at this point Moses had really nothing to do with where they were. You know, they were following a cloud, a giant pillar of fire. It wasn't Moses leading them into wherever he felt like going. And yet, what's the first thing they do? They blame Moses for bringing them out. But what's so cool here is just seeing Moses' response. You know, he didn't know at this point what was going to happen, aside from the fact that God had told him that he was going to get victory over the Egyptians, but he didn't know how that was going to happen yet. Later, God tells him kind of how he's going to do it, but at that point, he didn't know yet. But that line is something that I think we hear a lot. It's kind of quoted, "Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord." Moses doesn't freak out, and he doesn't say, "I'm not even sure what's going on, you know, don't blame me." He just simply tells them to stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. And that was the point that probably hit me the hardest in studying this, is that idea of standing still, of waiting. One of the commentaries I like to read is the Enduring Word commentary by David Guzik, and he really made this point pretty hard, that in a crisis, we're often stuck. The thing that makes it a crisis is the fact that we don't have options. Like, we can't really go anywhere. We're stuck, and something has to give. But in those times, we think that God's forgotten us because we don't have options, right? And so we're impatient. We're like, something's got to, you know, we got to do something here. And so what's the first thing we do often? We go talk to all our friends and family and like, how can we get out of this? How can we fix this? And sometimes we'll take matters into our own hands and just start shoving and pushing. And usually that doesn't end well either. But what's the thing that Moses says here? Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. So essentially he's saying, wait, just wait. Don't do anything. And I don't know, that really hit me, because when God did move, there was no question of what the next step was, right? It wasn't a, well, we have two options now because something's opened up. It was just, it became very clear, this is where we're going to walk when God moved. I don't think in the grand scheme of things humans are very patient. I think we probably all recognize that, especially now with cars and internet and jets and all the immediate things that we can have. So usually when we find ourselves in those tough situations, it's we turn to what we know that can get us immediate results instead of just standing still and trusting that God has something for us. And then when that opens up, we follow it. We know where to go. And I'm not saying this as, preaching at anyone or anything. I say this because I know what I'm like and I know what I've experienced. And looking back, I'm kind of ashamed at how I responded to tough situations sometimes. God knew what he was doing all along. If I could have saved myself a lot of stress and might have a few more hair, if I would have just trusted that God knew what he was doing and left it at that. Obviously, we see that Pharaoh isn't the sharpest saw blade in the shop here. He barrels ahead, and the thing that amazes me, that I never really thought about before, is I often thought that God didn't really move until the water comes crashing down, and Pharaoh wouldn't have known that God was still with them until that point. But that's not really the case, because you know the Israelites had gone. God was leading them with a cloud and fire. And then as the Egyptians get closer, he moves that around behind them. And so that's between them and the Egyptians. So they can't even get to him at that point. Now, wouldn't you at that point say, okay, so this God apparently is still with them. Like this is not just some mysterious force that happens to be moving. I mean, at this point, I think they would know this is obviously of God and God is still with them. There's a giant pillar of fire between us and them. Maybe we should call this a day and pack up our little chariots and go home. But no, they keep going. Like they stick it out. And I don't know, that again, I guess when you're so hardened against God, it like we talked about earlier, you kind of lose your ability to reason, even when it's something that's obviously going to destroy you. Marcus, you want to throw up that other map? The one thing that I didn't really understand terribly well before looking into this is the Red Sea is actually really big. If you look at the entire Red Sea, that center part, the main part of the Red Sea is about 100 miles wide, And we're talking about just one of those little fingers up on the end. So if you're ever looking at a map and you're like, I wonder where they crossed, it would have been one of those two little fingers going up there, not the entire Red Sea there. So just to give you a little bit of a context there. So obviously we know what happens next. The way God destroys the Egyptian army kind of adds another layer of interestingness, is that a word, to this story. God didn't just let the Israelite or the Egyptians go into the middle of the sea and then, you know, the water comes down and drowns them. From what I understood here, and I had never really dug into this before either, but it kind of appears to me that the Egyptians actually went across and possibly were coming out on the other side of the water already. And there's a couple of clues that kind of tell us that in chapter 14. But it says at that point their chariot wheels started getting heavy, and God looked down and threw them into, basically put fear on them. And they freaked out and like, oh, let's not do this after all. Let's get out of here. And so they run back into the waters is what it looks like. So it almost looks like they were already across, or at least partway across, and then they change their mind because they freak out and go tearing back into the middle of it. And I was like, why did God do that? And I don't know all the reasons for that. But one of my theories maybe is that there was absolutely no question who did this, who destroyed the Egyptians. Knowing how we humans are, I can just imagine one of the, you know, someone that was there, one of the Israelites that was there, telling stories to their grandkids and talking about how they marched out of Egypt and showed them who's boss, and then the Egyptians came tearing after us and we scared them off, and you know, make yourself look like the hero. But there was absolutely no question who did this part. I mean, if you do that, you're just straight up lying. There's no way you can say that it had anything to do with you, especially considering that the Egyptians were already across, if that is for sure the case. I mean, they were pretty much done for at that point. But then something comes on the Egyptians and they freak out and go tearing back in, and then God puts the water down on top of them. Obviously a God thing, and there's no way you can get around that. They didn't do anything to outsmart them. They didn't do anything to conquer them. This was purely on God, and he showed himself that he could do that. Okay. So we're already running out of time here. There's obviously a lot of things we can learn from this, and I'm not going to go into any more. I'm guessing many of you have similar, although probably somewhat less dramatic stories of how God has worked in your own kind of miniature Red Sea experience. And so I'd like to just leave it for you to share a couple of those if you have any. And so I'm going to end with that. And Dad, if you are you closing? Okay. So maybe if you just want to oversee that time, if there are any, and thank you for listening.